There was a fire. When Vasily opened his eyes, he saw the fire. But with his eyes opened or closed, he felt a fire burning in his head. His body was racked with chills, and Vasily Prokopyev realized he was naked. He lay there in the snow. The child. Where was the child? Oh. He moved his head slightly, and there was an explosion of pain that nearly brought on the blackness again. Where was the child? He could see feet covered with pieces of blanket, leggings made of uniform sleeves. He saw a pair of feet in his boots, but the boots were on wrong, the left worn on the right foot. It was maddening to see. But where was the child? The child was screaming. Then he saw it held down on the far side of the flames. Some of the wild tribesmen, he heard rumors, had resorted to cannibalism. As he strained his eyes to see past the flames, he saw something that almost made him scream. It was a bone, the size of a man's thigh. He remembered now. He'd been struck with a human bone. Why was the child screaming? He forced his eyes to focus. Several of the leathery-skinned men were bent over her. Were they raping her, the beasts? He saw the flicker of steel as fire flashed off it, a Soviet bayonet. He knew why the child was screaming when he saw one of the wild tribesmen raising a strip of white flesh to his mouth. Prokopyev got to his feet. He didn't know how. He stumbled and lurched past the flames, reached down into the snow, and caught up the human thigh bone. He crashed it down across the face of the man eating the flesh of the living child. As hands reached for him, he swung the thigh bone in every direction at once, striking foreheads, jaws, the crowns of skulls. A knife slashed toward him. He felt a horrible burning. He backhanded the human bone across the forearm of the wild tribesman holding the knife, then struck at the man's face again and again. He fell to the ground and rolled across the snow. Pain filled his abdomen. He tried to stand up. Pain washed over him, but he fought the darkness which was coming with it.
Little one.
He struggled to his knees. Vasily Prokopyev couldn't stand. He crawled, blood spilling onto the snow from his abdomen. Then he saw her, her body bluing with the cold. She was alive. John Rourke and Paul Rubinstein walked side by side along the Sub-Pen's main wharf. The sail of the recommissioned island carrier USS Roy Rogers stood as a huge monolith above the sails of the smaller midwake vessels. Men and women walked all around them, 8 or sometimes 10 abreast. Like John Rourke and his son-in-law and friend, each person carried or wore weapons and carried a pack with a few necessary belongings, each dressed in black battle dress utilities. There was no time for training as a unit. No time even for standardization of uniforms beyond those for the personnel of Midwake. Marines, naval personnel, all now were members of the 1st Special Operations Group, and those who lived would form the nucleus of the attack force with which the Allies would fight back. They were bound for the surface, where German helicopter gunships would land on the missile deck of the enormous island classer and ferry them to a nearby island, where Midwake personnel, along with German engineers, spent the last several hours preparing landing and departure zones for the J-7Vs that would fly them over the North Pole toward North America and from there to the staging area. Along the route, they would be joined by a token force of Chinese intelligence commandos under the command of Han Luchen. Some of the German personnel accompanying them were destined for the unit as well. Rourke spotted Otto Hammerschmidt. Pain etched Hammerschmidt's face. He was too soon out of the hospital, but to have left him behind would have dealt him a mortal blow. Enough of them were left behind. Annie Rubinstein watched the live television coverage as the 1st Special Operations Group moved along the wharf. She looked away from the television monitor embedded in the wall. It was nearly 2 yards diagonally. She turned her eyes to Natalia. Dr. Rothstein said she was doing well, that the sedation was all but eliminated. Natalia slept. Annie smiled. She looked back to the television screen. There was her father, well over 6 feet tall, the high forehead, his dark brown hair. She saw her husband, Paul, her very own. Not so tall, his hair thinning, not so big as John Rourke, but his stride just as confident. She loved him.
Don't die, either of you. Please.
Vasily bandaged the little girl before he bandaged himself. But that might have been a mistake. He was lightheaded from loss of blood. Massive blisters arose on his left leg, and as he fought the clothing onto his body, some of them burst, and he nearly fainted from the pain. He sat now, the dead surrounding him, rocking her by the fire, not certain what to do. The sky was too overcast to see stars, and the tribesmen who attacked them either discarded his pack or never took it from the half-track. In either event, he had no compass. Reaching the half-track, if he could, was his immediate goal, but he doubted the vehicle would be anything more than a shelter. The ignition switch was turned off, but the dome light was on. In this terrible cold, it most likely drained the batteries. The girl ran a fever, and he thought that he did as well. But there was another reason to reach the half-track, survival aside, even survival of the child. Secreted in the half-track was the canister containing the data on the particle beam technology. Delivering the data to Dr. Rourke was the purpose of his mission. Much of his own clothing was ripped or blood-drenched, but with scraps of clothing and his own boots, he covered his body. He used everything that was warm and cleanest of the rags to cover the little girl. When he stood, his abdomen ached. But the wound didn't seem deep, just bloody, a slash rather than a puncture. His leg hurt him more, from burns when he somehow passed through the flames. Vasily Prokopyev realized two things. The child's parents were not cannibals, too undernourished for that. And if he didn't set out for the half-track, in whatever direction it was right now, he would never leave the campsite alive. With the girl, who had passed into sleep or unconsciousness, nestled in his arms, his right arm still half-numb, he started to walk through the deep snow, his pistol freshly loaded and ready.
One step.
The little girl's face seemed to radiate heat. His leg burned. Chills, from pain not cold, traveled along his spine.
Another!
He held the child tight against him. Michael Rourke stood up, the eyes of Rolvag and the German officers riveted on him.
My father is leading a group against a force of Soviets attacking Eden Base. We all know that from the radio traffic your own people intercepted. But the Russians may know it too. I know we don't have any orders to do it, but with a refueling stop in northern Canada, a dozen gunships loaded with every missile and machine gun and every man you can spare from this command could surprise the Russians, could make the critical difference between victory and defeat.
Captain Hartmann, one of Wolfgang Mann's key officers, had flown over from the European front to personally supervise the evacuation and relocation of the Hecla community, under specific orders from Colonel Mann. Hartmann was scheduled to return to Europe, taking with him the bulk of his force, leaving a small but heavily armed helicopter assault group to see to the defense of the remaining Icelandic communities. If a decision could be made, Hartmann would be the one to make it. Michael sat down. Hartmann stood. He walked toward the north wall of the hermetically sealed, environmentally controlled tent. On the wall hung a map of the world.
Herr Rourke may have a point. Colonel Mann applauds initiative. He also very strongly disapproves of disobedience to orders. However, such a force as you suggest, Herr Rourke, 12 gunships, and an appropriate complement and men, material and fuel, might indeed have some impact. The most recent dispatches I am privy to indicates that a modest force moving in three distinct elements was dispatched from New Germany.
Hartmann pointed to the map of South America. His finger came to rest on what Michael had always called Argentina.
Logic dictates one element would fly along the American Gulf Coast. Here.
He gestured toward Texas.
Another would course along the Atlantic coast and end up along the Savannah River, then down. The third element flying a relatively direct course from the staging area in the Yucatan to Eden Base, thus minimizing the effect of any possible Soviet interdiction. The logical route for this special operations group led by Dr. Rourke is across the pole, refueling unnecessary, down along the Great Lakes and directly to Eden Base. Anticipating encountering Soviet resistance along the way, since the Soviet staging area is in extreme northern Georgia or the Carolinas. If, on the other hand, this small force Michael Rourke suggests were to fly from Iceland across the tip of Greenland, but fly onto here,
Hartmann gestured again to the map,
Hudson Bay, the gunships could then refuel and fly a central route, generally following the contours of the Mississippi River course, to the base of what was southern Illinois, then strike across the mountains over the site of the ruins of Atlanta directly to Eden Base, bypassing all likely Soviet intelligence, striking by surprise.
Can we do it?
It would be a mission I could not order my pilots to carry out, but I could ask for volunteers.
Every officer around the table, pilots all, stood. Michael Rourke looked at their faces, most younger than his, some his age or older.
Gentlemen, it appears I have sufficient volunteers. We will draw lots. The winners accompanying Michael Rourke. To walk that thin line between initiative in an officer and disregard for orders.
Hartman walked over to the table. He stood in front of a standing Michael Rourke.
So?
Yes.
I must leave with all good speed for the Earls. Somehow I have the feeling that there may be surprises forthcoming from the underground Soviet city, and I must be with my command when the surprises reveal themselves.
He looked at his wristwatch.
Leave within the hour, Michael, so you will make it on time. And good luck.
Hartman extended his right hand. Michael took it. John Rourke stood on the beach, the surf behind him, the sky so deep a blue it seemed impossible to imagine an aircraft of any sort could penetrate. He was dressed all in black. The wind blew his hair across his forehead. Despite the crashing of the surf and the numbers of men, there was no trouble hearing his voice. Paul Rubinstein stood at the rear of the group, knowing that he was watching history. The journal Paul kept increased in its fascination for him. These were the moments that would determine mankind's destiny.
Some of us have fought together before, side by side. You, Han Lu Chen, and you, Captain Hammerschmidt of the German Commandos, Captain Sam Aldridge of the United States Marine Corps, and Captain Jason Darkwood, commander of the USS Ronald Reagan. Now, I remind you, gentlemen and ladies, that a captain in the United States Navy is a field grade officer.
The laughter was mostly suppressed, and mostly from the Marines. Aldridge looked back at his men harshly. The Midwake forces were ranked into two platoons. At the head of one stood Lieutenant Tom Stanhope of the Reagan. The head of the other, Lieutenant Lily St. James of the Wayne, stood at parade rest. Aldridge stood at their head. Beside him, on his right, Jason Darkwood. There were three squads of the Chinese intelligence commandos under Han's command beside them. The Chinese were flanked on their opposite side by the Germans, Otto Hammerschmidt at their head, an entire platoon of commandos.
And then, of course, the man I consider my brother, Paul Rubinstein.
Paul felt his face flush despite the cold.
The president of Midwake gave me the rank of brigadier general. Now, that's fine, I suppose, but you men are military commanders. I'm not. If you're looking for someone to speak for me in my absence, it's Paul. His word is mine. In a moment, we'll be boarding the J-7V German aircraft. It's going to be a tight fit for all of us, and a first flying experience for many of us. Maybe that's the point why we're here. 5 centuries ago, mankind reached a height of technology. For each of you, had you lived then, would have been so used to flying, you would have welcomed the chance just to catch a nap. We've been reduced to warring tribes by what God only knows might have been an accident. Simply because the two greatest powers in the world then so terribly distrusted one another that they were willing to risk annihilation just in case. Well, just in case came, and here we are. We can never reclaim the billions of lives lost, the billions more never born. But we can try to keep the insanity from happening again. What I'm saying is that we're warriors for peace, for without it, the world will end for good this time. None of your children, your lovers, none of you will ever walk a beach again, watch a bird in flight, ride a horse, pet a dog. Never, never, unless we win. Should we hate our enemies? No, they aren't any different, most of them. We want the leaders, but to get to them, we'll have to kill a lot of people. People who, in other times, in other places, we might have counted as friends if given the chance to know them. The ultimate idiocy is warfare. But we're in it, and no one asked us if we wanted it. To end it, we have to win it. And so we'll board the aircraft. Some of us will be landed. A few of us will jump. We'll fight. And some of us won't come back. Every person here volunteered for this. Well, except for Paul and me. If we win, and I won't insult your intelligence by saying when we win, because we're the good guys and it happens that way in books. But if we win, those of us who don't make it will be remembered every time someone draws a free breath. Not your name or mine, but what we did. I think it's time unit leaders got their men aboard the J-7Vs. You might not like American Georgia now. 5 centuries ago, the climate was generally benign. The people were friendly. The laws were livable and the scenery spectacular. Now it's just a battleground of a war that needs winning. Let's go!
Tan Hut, hand salute.
The men and women of the 1st Special Operations Group saluted John Rourke. Paul Rubenstein watched, almost sorry he wasn't military so he could do it too. Where was it, Vasily wondered. But there was no time to wonder, only walk, dragging his left leg, and the unnatural warmth there that sickened him when he thought of it. His eyes shifted moment to moment between the gray of the path he followed through the snow and the child's face. If she stopped breathing, Vasily Prokopyev suddenly realized that this child of the wild tribes was more important to him than even the canister containing the secrets of the particle beam technology. Saving her life was his obsession. He recognized the signs. His toes no longer responded when his mind told them to wiggle. His skin felt warm, despite the wind. He knew if he were to lie down, he would sleep forever. Yet, though awake, he dreamed. He pictured his mother, a face vaguely remembered, who came to the state-run facility where he had been privileged to attend. He saw the first girl whose body he touched below the neck and above the knee.
I must save the girl.
He thought earlier what he might do with the child, find a home for her. It was said the Germans treated the people of the wild tribes with humanity, that there was some effort to re-civilize them. Surely there would be a family of these people who would like to have such a beautiful child as their own. He kept walking, the movement an end unto itself, because while he walked, he could not close his eyes for more than a few seconds, and he could not die. That was silly. Of course he could die. He could close his eyes and fall down and never know that he had fallen. Perhaps he already had. Perhaps all of this was just a dream, a reliving of life's horrors. He suddenly remembered the first time he killed another human being. Sadness welled up in him, but he was not afraid of tears. He tried to blink them away. What was the sound? Another avalanche? It was so loud. It was them. More of the cannibals, coming back for more of the child's flesh. Vasily Prokopyev moved his feet faster. The sound grew louder. No rocks or snow blocked his way. He was amazed at himself. He could still run. He fell.
Little one!
A light flashed.
Oh, quick! Over here!
The light failed, was gone. He held her, assuring himself of her breathing. She was so very hot, and his arms were so very stiff that he could not have released her had he wanted to. Darkness overcame him. Something moved Vasily.
Can you hear me?
Vasily could not understand. Was it the language of angels?
I have something for you.
What words were these? He felt something warm in his throat. He felt he would vomit it up if he could ever swallow it. He tried sitting up.
No, lie down. Rest.
He fell back.
That's better. Just rest.
He wanted to ask them where she was, because his arms moved, and they shouldn't have moved at all if he still held her. Maybe his lips did not work, or his tongue. Again, he tried to sit up.
Please, lie down. You must rest.
Vasily opened his eyes. They were not angels. They were Germans. Did the Germans do the terrible things it was said they did? Would they kill a small child? He was inside an aircraft of some type, a large aircraft. And another German, his helmet off, his eyes smiling, dropped to his knees. In his arms was the little one. She was crying. To cry, it was necessary to live. Now, Vasily Prokopyev could sleep. Snipers. Wolfgang Mann estimated at least a dozen harassed the German troops as assembly finished on the breastworks. Incoming mortar fire, at first erratic, grew in intensity. One of the Eden shuttlecraft was slightly damaged. Sarah Rourke, the sleeves of her black BDU blouse rolled up past her elbows, assisted the German and American doctors in preparing for the wave of casualties to come. So far, 2 deaths and 5 wounds of varying degrees of severity, easily handled by the medical staff. She knew John would be coming, but his coming soon enough was the key. Michael Rourke sat on the long bench, Rolvag on one side of him, a German lieutenant on the other, Hrothgar lying across Rolvag's feet. Michael had turned to the side on the bench as a medic dressed the wound to his left arm. The sound of the chopper engines and the urgency of the moment made it impossible for anyone to sleep, with the exception of Bjorn Rolvag and his dog. Rolvag returned the sword to Madame Jokli. Once again, Rolvag carried only his staff. For Rolvag, warfare wasn't that serious, Michael supposed, so carrying a blade, not to mention a gun, wasn't justified. When the medic was through, Michael Rourke sat back, trying to read. The book was the pilot's manual for the J-7V. He thought of Maria as he read the text she had translated for him. He loved her, but wondered if that was enough. Anyone who fell in love with a Rourke would have to be very much in love, for life with a Rourke meant mostly loneliness and partings.
Am I too much like my father?
Michael Rourke closed the manual and tried to sleep. He knew he couldn't. He had too much to think of, and Maria above all. John Rourke sat in the co-pilot seat of the J-7V, but he surrendered it and moved back along the fuselage toward where Jason Darkwood sat, hands glued to the armrests of his seat.
Captain?
Dr. Rourke, how do you stand flying long distances? That helicopter ride, well, that was different, but this goes on, and all there is around you is nothing.
John Rourke smiled and sat down beside him.
Years ago, you would have thought traveling by air was about as natural as driving a car. You know, a personal automobile?
When I was a kid, the idea of having a car fascinated me. I wanted a Ferrari. I used to watch all the old video stuff I could get my hands on just to see the cars, but I wanted a Ferrari. There was some policeman in Hawaii, I think. And there was another one, a private detective or something in Florida before it fell into the sea.
Rourke didn't smile. He was there when it happened.
The cop was in Miami. His Ferrari was white. The private detective was the one in Hawaii, and his car was red.
Yeah, that's it. What kind of car did you drive then, Doctor?
Station wagon or a pickup truck.
Station wagon? Well, yeah. Oh, wait a minute. The boxy ones people always had in their driveways in videos that were set in, what were they called, the suburbs. And people who lived in rural areas drove pickup trucks.
John Rourke kept listening out of politeness, but memories of the life before weren't historical trivia to him. It was a precious, mundane normalcy that would never come back. Damien Rausch saw his face and turned away. It was Akira Kuranami, alive. He dropped into a crouch on the walkway there. The wind and blowing snow swirled around them. He removed the magazine from his rifle, pretending there was something wrong with it. It was a stroke of luck that he made it to Eden Base. The helicopter he and his ill-fated party used to reach the area near the retreat was so well camouflaged it wasn't discovered by the J-7Vs of the Germans or the long-range gunships of the Soviets. Luck, possibly bad luck in light of the fact that he was trapped here now, trapped in Eden. After the night of freezing there in the rocks near Dr. Rourke's retreat, he was faced with escaping the advancing Soviets. He could have entered the retreat if he'd had the proper explosives available to him, but then what? He went back to the German gunship, one of the helicopters given over by the German command to Eden Base for its use. He flew back, told Dodd most of what happened. But by that time, the area was swarming with German personnel under the command of the traitorous Wolfgang Mann. He could have escaped the base, but to where? He faced anti-Nazi forces all around him and more coming in. Soviet forces virtually surrounded Eden Base, their numbers growing.
Yes, this is bad. But in the confusion of war, there is opportunity.
It would be very easy to shoot Kuranami off the wall. The Japanese naval aviator moved very stiffly. He evidently took a bullet in his side there at the retreat of Dr. Rourke.
Yes, I'll wait for the heat of the battle.
Heat was turning up. In the distance, to the north, through the telescope mounted in the carry handle of his rifle, he could see a growing force of black Soviet gunships, a solid wall of black that would be falling down upon them. It would be ironic, Rausch realized, if he and everyone else here were killed, fighting in this battle. But the historic destiny of National Socialism would only be postponed, never stopped. He pulled up the hood of his parka, closer around his face as he resumed his position on the wall. Kuranami would not realize he was here, not until it was too late. Sarah Rourke, her coat closed over her swollen abdomen, her pistol belt in place, an assault rifle in her hands, moved along the base of the breastworks. She searched for a German officer, so through him she could find Colonel Mann.
They don't need me tending the sick. They do need me with a gun in my hand. There aren't enough Eden personnel who've seen battle. None of them have fought like me.
She found a senior non-com.
Do you speak English?
Yes, Frau Rock.
You recognize me. Good. Where's Colonel Mann? Herr Colonel Mann.
The sergeant pointed above them as a J-7B squadron passed overhead. She closed her eyes for an instant and opened them.
Where on the wall do you need more people?
His eyes showed surprise as they drifted down to look at her obviously swollen abdomen.
So I'm pregnant. What the hell's that got to do with it?
And now he looked a little frightened.
There, Frau Rock. 50 meters down.
Right!
She let him go and walked in the direction he'd pointed. As she narrowed the distance, she felt herself smile. She would be right near Akira Kuranami and could look out for him on behalf of Elaine. Sarah quickened her pace. Paul Rubinstein sat beside the J-7V's radio operator. Han Lu Chen, the Chinese Secret Service agent, stood next to him. A German officer translated as the coded transmission was deciphered. John sat at the co-pilot's controls.
Soviet gunships have just gone airborne, circling the compound, firing missiles into it. The squadron of J-7Vs under the personal command of Colonel Mann has sustained 10% casualties. A breach in the breastwork wall surrounding Eden Base due to a missile strike cannot be repaired. The compound defenders are currently holding the area. Soviet ground troops are advancing against Eden Base under cover of heavy mortar, missile, and machine gun fire. Casualty rates for the compound defenders to follow. Colonel Mann instructs that support elements make all good speed to Eden Base.
They can't hold out much longer.
Paul felt stupid for sharing his Captain Obvious remark. John said nothing. Sarah was there. Might be dead. Paul looked at his watch. They were an hour from Eden, at least that.
Shit!
I am reminded of a story I once read concerning a group of brave Americans in a place called Texas. For many days they held out. The brave defenders at Eden Base must only wait one more hour, Paul.
Paul Rubinstein looked away.
That was the Alamo. Santa Ana's forces didn't have helicopters and missiles and automatic rifles and mortars. But anyway, Han, remember the end of the story?
The Chinese nodded soberly.
All of the Texans died.
Paul Rubinstein began to say something, but the German radio translator held up his finger.
This message still being decrypted. Something about the three elements of the relief force from New Germany.
Paul leaned over the radio operator's shoulder, staring at the code books and cipher pads as if he could read them. John Rourke, stonily silent, stood behind him.
Relief force cannot proceed from the Yucatan Peninsula, grounded by tropical depression off the Gulf of Mexico now at hurricane force. I repeat, the relief force is grounded. When they hear of this, I know the men and women fighting from the wall, those courageous pilots still in the air, will continue to fight until the last.
The German officer looked up.
It is personally dispatched by the colonel.
Paul's eyes left the young officer's face and followed John's hand as he snatched up the radio headset the operator had just set down.
Give me the right frequency. Now, I want to reach all elements of the Special Operations Group.
Yes, Herr General.
John's eyebrows raised, but he said nothing.
I have it now, Herr General.
This is John Rourke to all elements of Special Operations Group 1. For those who require it, please provide simultaneous translation. We have just received a communique signed personally by Colonel Mann, commanding the defense of Eden Base. The relief force from New Germany is trapped on the Yucatan Peninsula by a hurricane. That means we're all the help Eden Base is going to get. Brave men and women are fighting there and dying. We're 1 hour off. When we reach Eden, we go in. We'll be heavily outnumbered, but we're the only hope they've got. God bless us all.
John Rourke threw down the headset, then smashed his fist against the bulkhead. Sarah Rourke brushed away a crease in the mound of drifted snow as she peered through the firing niche in the wall beside her. Her ears rang with the chaos of the Battle of Eden Base. The Soviet gunships were massing for another assault. The lead elements of the Soviet ground forces were within 500 yards of the wall. Their next charge would take them to the base of the wall and over it. There was a second breach in the breastworks on the north wall. Fewer and fewer of Colonel Mann's J-7Bs were able to get airborne again. Mortar fire and missiles all but closed the roadway airfield and destroyed many of the craft while on the ground for replenishment of armament. Two of the J-7Vs landed within the compound itself. Word of the grounded reinforcement elements traveled along the wall faster than wind. The three prongs of reinforcements from New Germany and Argentina could not get through. Some storm or something.
That's just a rumor. They can fly above the storm or around it. That might cause a delay. They'll be here.
A hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico has grounded the anticipated relief forces at their staging area on the Yucatan Peninsula for an unspecified period of time. The only relief force we can expect is the 1st Special Operations Group from Midway. They are currently 10 minutes overdue, and we have received no communication from them for the last half hour. We cannot surrender. We must fight here and win, or fight here and die. I have never known persons whose bravery and personal courage I respected more.
Sarah stared at the faces of some of the less seriously wounded German aviators who had come up to the wall and assumed firing positions. She could see the meaning of his words in their eyes.
John.
The black insect shapes of the Soviet gunships came now from over the northern horizon, and the ground forces started moving. She checked her rifle and noticed the man beside her, a handsome man. The kind of face that wouldn't have been easy to forget. But somehow she couldn't remember ever having seen him here at Eden before.
It appears that your famous husband is otherwise engaged, doesn't it?
She wouldn't look at him again. The Soviet ground forces were 300 yards off now. The helicopters of the Soviet fleet flew zigzag patterns over the infantry, protecting them. German helicopter gunships went airborne along with the few remaining J-7Bs. Sarah placed the muzzle of her rifle through the niche in the wall. The Soviet ground forces were now just slightly more than 200 yards off. Akira Kurinami, captain of the wall due to the respect everyone at Eden and all of the Germans held for him because of his courage, stood about 10 yards from her.
Fire!
John Rourke walked at the head of the ragged wedge of men, the snow thigh-deep here on the side of the hill to the south of Eden Base. Over the brow of the hill, he knew, would be the roadway that had become the runway for the landing Eden Project space shuttles, the hope of mankind. The radio receiver in his ear connecting him to Paul in the Command J-7V came to life.
John, everything's set. I say again, everything is set.
John Rourke kept walking and pulled the teardrop microphone into place.
The order is given. Attack squadrons 1, 3, and 4, go! I say again, go! Ground Force Elements Bravo and Charlie, move up! I say again, move up! Airborne Elements 1, 2, and 3, commence drop! I say again, commence drop!
John Rourke stripped away the earpiece, clipped it to the collar of his parka, and waved his left hand toward the brow of the hill. There were no Bravo and Charlie ground force elements, only this single unit composed of the Marine and Naval personnel from Midway and the Chinese forces under the command of Han Lu Chen. Nor were there multiple elements of paratroopers or J-7V fighter bombers. But the more the enemy believed were coming, the more confusion Rourke hoped he could cause. At the top of the hill, they stopped. For the first time, the Americans and Chinese saw the Eden Project space shuttle fleet assembled on the roadway. The sight of the shuttles, specters of the 20th century, stunned and amazed these warriors of the 26th century.
I never imagined they were so beautiful.
There were the wrecks of more than a half dozen German J-7Bs strewn about as well, some of them still afire. On closer examination, one of the space shuttles itself had been damaged by a missile strike or mortar round. To the side of the road, the snow-covered, partially complete permanent structures of Eden Base stood, empty, lifeless. Across the flat expanse to the other side of the road lay Eden Base, gray walls surrounding it, breached in places, in other places merely blackened. German helicopter gunships and precious few J-7Vs were engaged in aerial combat with black Soviet gunships. Missile contrails streaked through the snow-swirling sky like lightning bolts. John Rourke looked at Jason Darkwood, then at Aldridge, Stanhope, and St. James.
Captain Aldridge, like we talked about, please.
Yes, sir. Stanhope, take your people across that road quick and easy, using the space shuttles for cover until you reach those partially finished buildings over there. I'll be accompanying you.
Yes, sir.
St. James.
Sir.
Cover Stanhope's people as they cross the road. We'll do the same for you after we're in position. Then we hit the right flank of those commies out there.
Yes, sir.
Both of you, move your people out.
Stanhope and St. James rendered quick hand salutes. Aldridge nodded as he snapped one back and broke into a run beside Stanhope, rifle at high port. John Rourke looked to Han Lu Chen and Jason Darkwood.
Just like we said. Let's go!
John Rourke ran diagonally across the slope, skidding through the snow. He caught himself and took off running. Looking back, he spotted Han Lu Chen's small force of Chinese commandos, Han himself and Jason Darkwood right behind, heading toward the road. They reached the road, well beyond the position from which Aldridge, Stanhope, and Stanhope's platoon were already starting to cross, cutting across the road as quickly as they could. Rourke signaled a halt in the ruins of the old bridge Natalia blew on the day the space shuttles first landed. Rourke grabbed up his armored binoculars, focusing them skyward. The J-7Vs under his command were split into three elements, closing from the east, the west, and the south. The aircraft coming in from the south, directly over his head now, released jumpers. The sky above the hillside over the road and over the bridge where Rourke and his element waited, filled with German airborne commandos. The elements that converged from the east and west were already engaging Soviet gunships. Rourke planned ahead. Despite the fact that terrain following cost them precious time, they successfully evaded detection by Soviet sensing equipment. That was clear now as the Soviet formations broke while their air attack fell apart. Paratroopers were landing now, some of them within the Eden base walls, others just outside. But others of the German commandos died on the way down as Soviet ground forces and Soviet gunships strafed them with machine guns. John Rourke looked at Darkwood.
Are you ready?
You mean maybe I should have stayed at home on my submarine? I'm ready.
Rourke whacked the front handguard of his M16 as he stood, then ran.
Kai!
John ran, and Darkwood, Han Lu Chen, and the Chinese intelligence commandos formed up around him. Rourke heard the whistle and looked up.
Lu Chen!
John hit the snowy ground as the mortar blew. In a shower of snow, dirt, and rocks, Rourke was already on his feet.
Be quick!
Already the rhythm of the gunfire changed. He looked to his left and saw Aldridge's two platoons of United States Marines engaging the farthest right flank of the Soviet ground forces. The closest side of the wall surrounding Eden Base was some 300 yards away. German commandos scrambled over it to the relative safety inside. From the north, a phalanx of Soviet gunships came in low.
Lu Chen! Lu Chen!
Rourke pointed to the sky, alerting the men as they kept running. There was a large bomb crater, and nearby, the charred remains of a J-7V and a Soviet gunship, apparently the two having crashed in midair. Rourke dropped down into the bomb crater. The wall was less than 200 yards away now. The Soviet gunships coming from the north streaked overhead, spraying the ground on either side of the crater. The wreckage from the two aircraft rocked under the bullets' impacts.
They must have held them in reserve.
Rourke looked after the Soviet gunships. They were banking, coming around for another pass.
We gotta reach that wall! Fast!
Rourke pushed himself up, the M16 in his right fist over his head.
Kai! Kai!
Rourke stopped. He signaled the others on and shouldered his rifle, firing at the lead chopper. Machine gun fire strafed across the ground and he ran, catching up with Darkwood and Han Lu Chen.
Kai! Kai!
By the breach in the wall, John saw her, Sarah. She was screaming something. He couldn't hear her, but he knew what she meant. Two of the Chinese were down dead, a third dragged between two other men. At the wall, John ducked, threw his rifle to his shoulder, and fired at the choppers as they angled off. Behind him, Han Lu Chen urged his men through. Darkwood and Han, just over the rubble by the breach, fired their assault rifles toward the gunships. Rourke flipped a three-foot-high section of wall and dropped into the snow. Sarah dropped to her knees beside him.
The fighting's heaviest on the north wall, but I knew you'd be coming this way.
She threw her arms around his neck and kissed him.
I love you, Sarah, but we still got some fighting to do. Han, get someone to see to your wounded. To the north wall. Come on. Kai!
Sarah fell behind, but pregnant as she was, he knew she would. The center of the compound reminded him of hell. Half-demolished modular structures and hermetically sealed tents burned. Construction vehicles lay overturned where mortars blew. Rourke dodged craters, running for the north wall. Otto Hammerschmidt was moving across the compound, not running, but under his own power.
Doctor, the north wall is the worst.
Right!
John Rourke reached the north wall, Darkwood beside him. On the walkway at mid-height of the wall, he saw Akira Kuranami rallying men along the walkway toward the breach some 50 feet down. Rourke turned to the Chinese commandos and pointed toward the breach in the wall.
Kai!
Sarah was coming, her rifle in both hands, Otto Hammerschmidt beside her. Rourke ran to the breach, Darkwood with him. Aldridge's Marines were stopped, perhaps a quarter mile off from the wall, nearly a third of the Soviet ground forces engaged with them. And from the north, the sky was darkening with Soviet gunships. More Soviet ground forces fought their way toward the wall. Rourke put his earpiece back in.
Halt! I'm at the north wall! Those gunships coming from the north, you've got to engage them!
We're working on it, John. I've got six J-7Vs breaking off now. Look out! They're coming over your position.
The J-7Vs streaked overhead. John involuntarily ducked.
Wow!
The Soviet gunships were closing. Half of them broke off to engage the J-7Vs. The remainder dropped repelling lines.
Paul, I'm taking some men to nail down those propellers as they hit. Watch out for them.
Roger that, John. God bless.
Rourke looked to the men at the breach surrounding him, choosing from the men he brought with him. Hammerschmidt and some of the German paratroop commandos, some Eden personnel. Sarah held his arm.
Gotta stop those men rappelling down from the gunship! Who's with me?
Rourke clambered over the debris, Darkwood beside him. The Soviet forces already on the ground were closing on the wall. John Rourke fired his M16 again and again, three-round bursts, cutting men down. Something tore at his sleeve, a bullet, he guessed, but he felt no wound. He kept moving, the men on either side of him in a wedge. The M16 was empty. Rourke changed magazines. He kept running, forward, shooting down a Soviet officer, jumping over his body. Soviet ground force personnel were all around them now. Darkwood's assault rifle was empty. The submarine commander butt-stroked a Soviet elite corpsman in the face. Jason grabbed up the dead man's rifle and fought on. Han Lu Chen, an American M16 in his right hand, his Chinese Glock pistol in his left, aimed both weapons into a knot of elite corpsmen. He took a bayonet across his left thigh as he spun to meet the third man, firing his pistol into the elite corpsman's face.
I am all right!
Firing the .44 Magnum revolver in his left fist, the M16 in his right, John Rourke fought his way forward, perhaps half of the force rappelling from the chopper already on the ground. This was it, Rourke realized. Superior odds were one thing, but these were just too high. Over the northern horizon, he saw more gunships, but there was something.
Paul, do you read me?
Sounds like... yes, those gunships. Those are us, John. It's Michael. There are a dozen gunships, and Michael and a platoon of German commandos are ready to rope down.
Rourke thrust the 629 into its holster and ran. Darkwood was using a Soviet assault rifle like a baseball bat, swatting down men on either side of him. John Rourke fired the M16, the last burst gone. Darkwood took a hit, stumbled, swinging the rifle with one hand. John Rourke, detonics in hand, closed with the men surrounding Darkwood, firing, killing. Darkwood, weaponless except for a massive Bowie knife, stood beside him. John Rourke handed him one of the twin detonics miniguns.
Only seven shots, but cheer up, I usually only load six.
Rourke drew the LS-10 knife from his side. Darkwood beside him, he moved forward. Ropes dropped from the German gunships. Under the covering fire of John Rourke's team, Michael and his men rappelled safely to Earth. Something tore across Rourke's right shoulder and back, and he fell to his knees, sprawling forward. Two elite corpsmen came for him. He emptied the pistol into both men. Lurching to his feet, he dropped the little .45 into his coat pocket. The M16 was still empty at his side. He picked up one of the rifles dropped by the dead men. He fired it out, then reloaded the M16 with a fresh magazine. A rifle in each hand, he moved on. He moved to his son, Michael. They stood together for an instant, back-to-back, fighting.
They're pulling back, John! They're pulling back!
Keep at him, Paul!
Rourke turned to his son.
Michael! You see Darkwood over there?
Yes!
Let's link up and go get him!
Already, the Soviet ground forces were falling back, pursued by the German commandos. Strafing runs from the German helicopters cut the elite corpsmen down as they fell back.
I'm with you!
We're winning! They're pulling out!
John Rourke, Michael Rourke, Han Lu Chen, and Jason Darkwood stood together. Darkwood handed back Rourke's pistol.
Well, you're bleeding, Doctor.
Rourke smiled at Darkwood.
Yeah, well, so are you.
Rourke looked at Han Lu Chen.
And so, for that matter, are you.
Han shrugged. John Rourke looked at his son and his two friends.
Let's get going.
The men from the North Defensive Wall of Eden Base, the Chinese commandos, the Germans, all fell in around John and Michael Rourke, Jason Darkwood, and Han Lu Chen. They formed a ragged line. There was still fighting to do as their force moved northward. But Paul had said it well. We're winning. Soviet infantry were caught between the walls surrounding Eden Base. Marines closed toward the wall. The forces John Rourke led were closing the trap, and Sarah Rourke couldn't have a part of it. Perhaps three dozen Soviets, no more than that, stood fighting to the death rather than surrendering. She didn't want to see it. Akira Kuranami stood some few feet from her, beside the breach in the wall.
Fire over their heads! Slaughtering them is useless! Fire!
Sarah looked up. There were tears in Akira's eyes. The Soviets would not give up.
Fire at will!
One of the wall defenders went down wounded. Chunks of debris flew. As Sarah Rourke looked away, she saw the good-looking man, the one who spoke to her with such perfect English, the one she didn't recognize from the Eden personnel. There was a rifle in his hands, and he raised the rifle to his shoulder. Her eyes flicked from the rifle to where it was aimed.
Akira!
The little Trapper Scorpion .45 was in her hand. She was on her knees beside the wall. She pointed the pistol. Sarah Rourke sagged to her knees. The hand which held the empty pistol shook. Survivalist Final Rain is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1989, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Mort Shelby, M.B. Van Dorn, Dylan Lynch, Ken Jackson, Christopher Graybill, Eric Messner, Michael Glenn, Ren Casey, Stephen Carpenter, Lily David, Thomas Penny, M.J. Casey, Tom Simpson, Jeff Baker, Lily Beacon, David Coyne, James Konacek, Sonny Lasky, Scott McCormick, Tony Nam, Laura Quinn Anderson, Richard Rowan, and Nanette Savard. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Timothy Lynch. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing, graphic audio sound design, and original music by Brian Patton. Adapted for graphic audio by Timothy Lynch. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for Ryder Stacey's Doomsday Warrior, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Edge of the Seat thriller in Graphic Audio.
The following previews are of Graphic Audio productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Falcon, Mrs. Custer told me something that I'd never heard before. She told me that you were with her husband when he was killed.
I wasn't with him at the exact time he was killed. I was with Benteen and Reno when the general was killed.
Why haven't I heard this about you before?
Because my being there was an accident of sorts. A lot of good men gave their last full measure of devotion on that day. I never felt it was right to detract from their honor by interjecting myself.
I wonder, Falcon, would you share the story with me now?
It's been over 50 years, and I've never told this story to anyone before. I'm not sure I can do it justice. Well, I warn you, it's a long story.
I'm a novelist, Falcon. I deal in long stories. Please, go ahead.
Well now, the year 1876 was what historians would call an eventful year. In Philadelphia, they celebrated our country's centennial. Colorado became a state. They invented the telephone. And at a lonely place in Montana, General Custer and 265 brave men were killed.
Colonel McAllister, this way! Damn! You're one hell of an engine fighter, Falcon. I've been at this game for a long time. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that.
I'll be damned.
What is it?
The Colorado Home Guard is missing 100 rifles. It looks like we just found a few of them.
You mean in addition to the Gatling guns we're looking for, there's also a bunch of repeating rifles out there?
Sweet fancy Moses, look at that!
Have you ever seen that many Indians at one time?
No, sir, I have not. Two Bears was right. These engines is coming from everywhere.
We have to tell Custer about this. I don't think he has any idea what he's letting himself in for.
You don't really know the General all that well, do you?
I haven't known him very long. Why do you ask?
Because it ain't gonna make no never mind what we tell him. He has his mind made up to go after the engines, and that's exactly what he's gonna do.
We've got them this time! We've got them, boys! Trumpeter Martin!
Don't miss the saga of Falcon McAllister at the Little Bighorn and Eagles 14, Bloodshed of Eagles. Available now in Graphic Audio.
What is your name?
Anya Creed.
I see.
Who are you?
My name is Agamemnon. We have your passport here.
They took it from me when I was kidnapped.
We will videotape your beheading and then broadcast it all over the world.
Beheading?
Are you afraid to die?
I faced death before.
I will kill you!
Don't move. Who are you?
My name is Anya Creed. The Abu Sayyaf kidnapped me several days ago. I have no idea where I am. You live here, or are you just passing through?
Gunnery Sergeant Vic Gutierrez, United States Marine Corps.
Something bothering you, Vic?
I got this feeling like someone's keeping an eye on us.
Excuse me!
What happened?
Anya, wake up and pay attention.
Where are we?
You are in a cavern located far beneath the surface of the jungle. You're wasting your time. You would need to be a lot stronger than you are in order to break free. Besides, you are to be sacrificed to our god.
I don't believe you.
Very well. You believe now, don't you?
Oh, great.
Oh, crap.
Rogue Angel 18. Sacrifice. In graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include 5 books of a series, available only at www.graphicaudio.net.